Our divine creativity is what sees us through times of difficulty. We have faced challenges in life, and what sees us through is when we begin to look at life differently, when we begin to believe about life differently, then we can recognize that there's a breakthrough possible in every part of life. And the key for us is to use insight, what we call insight or inspiration, that is not just about a psychological truth, but is about the truth of God. When we think of our word inspiration, one part of it means to breathe in. The other part of it means to get an idea. And we recognize in the ancient language of Hebrew and Greek and Latin and Sanskrit that breath and spirit were the same word in each of those languages. And so inspiration is about breathing in an awareness of God, breathing in an awareness that something larger is working in our lives. And so when we face the tough times that inevitably come in our human experience, we know that God is not just there, but God is breathing through us with an energy of life, an energy of overcoming in every experience, in every moment. Now, many times we turn and we want life to work a certain way. There was a 13-year-old who was asked about what his prayer was, and his prayer is this: give me the strength to change the things I can, the grace to accept the things I cannot, and a great big bag of money. We look so many times for a material solution to life. If we just have enough money, that'll take care of it. And we know that the government has thrown money at all kinds of problems through the decades, through the centuries, and it hasn't solved them, has it? Money is not the answer. Money can be helpful, but money has to be guided. Money has to have something out of which it comes and something with which it is moved and directed to become effective, to become worthwhile. And so in our own lives, we recognize that what we really want is a different idea. And that's what creativity is about. Taking something and having a different idea about it. Most of the wonderful inventions that we have come to take for granted came because there was some kind of a problem, some kind of a challenge facing someone. And rather than being stuck by that, they looked at it in a different way. And by looking at it in a different way, something came forth. And they maybe combined things in a way that hadn't been combined before, or used something in a different way. You know, we even see sometimes the evidence in animals. One of the things that I thought was most curious one time watching a program about chimpanzees, and one of the things that they like to eat is ants. Doesn't appeal to us so much. But what the chimp would do is take a stick and put it down in the ant hole and lift it out, and there's all these ants on it, and it would just lick them off. And it was a very simple way of them trying to dig for the ants. Put the stick in and the ants would come onto the stick. And so realize that creativity can even take place with the animals. And if they have it, we certainly have it too. And so for us to be willing to look to something larger. In Paul's letter to the Romans in the 8th chapter, which is just filled with wonderful, wonderful things, starting with the 14th verse, it says, because those who are led by the Spirit of God are called the children of God. So when we open ourselves to God, then we're considered children of God, which means we've accepted ourselves in that role. For you did not receive a spirit that makes you a slave again to fear. But you received the spirit of sonship, which means to see that we are heirs of God. And by that spirit we cry, Abba, which is the Aramaic word that's usually translated as father. The closer translation is daddy. And so when we call to God as daddy, as mother, as father, as that intimate presence. The Spirit itself testifies with our spirit that we are God's children. Now, if we are children, then heirs. Heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we share, and the usual translation is in his sufferings, but the word there is a compound word, and what it really means is if we share in a consciousness of oneness, in order that we may also share in the glory. Then he goes on, he says, I consider our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. The creation waits with eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. And the image there is that of a mother giving birth, waiting with eager expectation for that birthing process to take place. Now we can think of a physical birthing process, or we can think of the birth of an idea, the birth of a new career, the birth of a relationship, the birth of some kind of change that we want to make in our lives. And inevitably, what happens when we make a decision to make some kind of change, resistance seems to show up. Difficulty, challenges. People will say, you're never going to be able to do that. And so it's important for us to recognize that in any birthing process, there's what's called travail. And it's that work that it takes. You know, we call it birthing labor because there's an energy that has to go with that. And we recognize that in any birthing process, there is an energy that needs to come forth. And it seems like a challenge, and there are difficulties and obstacles that show up. But we also need to remember that who we are as children of God, as co-heirs with Christ, is bigger than anything that shows up. And so that Spirit of God is with us through all those things. In the Old Testament book of Isaiah, the king of the southern kingdom of Judah is faced with his northern neighbor and another king who come to attack. And he's afraid. But Isaiah, as the prophet, comes and speaks to him for God and gives him a message and says that I am with you and I will see you through. And what Isaiah says to the king is, you need to ask God for a sign. And the king says, I'm not going to ask God for a sign. And so what Isaiah says then, he says, well, you're not willing to trust circumstances, you're not willing to trust God, but God's going to show you. And we have that famous that says that a virgin shall give birth. And what it says in this context, this is Isaiah 7, it says that by the time this child is born and is able to eat curds or butter and honey, is at the time that it'll be able to make decisions. So it says by the time the kid is, you know, 7 or so, it's the time where they can make decisions for themselves, begin to make decisions. It says, before that time, I will deliver you. Before that time, when the child can make its own decisions, I will deliver you from those two kings. They will be destroyed. And that's what happened. But he also said to this king, because you didn't trust, because you didn't believe, I'm going to send another king who's going to get you. And what this is about is learning to believe that God will see us through. Rather than praying for courage and strength and wisdom and a big bag of money, because we trust the money more than we trust God, to recognize, to look for that Spirit of God to show us through the circumstances, to give us that creative energy in many different ways. But we have in Revelation this wonderful chapter 12. And this is probably one of the easiest chapters to look at with it, even though it has a couple of strange things. A great and wondrous sign appeared in the heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. What does it mean to be clothed with the sun? You know, again, it's an image, an Eastern image that's trying to get us caught up into a sense of radiance, this radiance of light clothed with the sun. Now, we've already heard that things have happened to the sun, right? It's turned red and all these different things. So again, here's a different image using this light again. It's not about looking to an outer light, but that image. With the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head, she was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. So this is the image. Now, who is the woman? If we turn to the end of this chapter, we get a clue. There's a historical meaning as well as our metaphysical meaning. It says, then the dragon, who we'll see him in a minute, was enraged at the woman and went off to make war upon the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's command and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So this, in a historical sense, what the woman represents is the church, the early Christian church, who is giving birth to a new expression. But in a mystical sense, what this woman represents is our creative abilities. And just think of that radiance, clothed in the sun, with the moon under her feet. The moon was used to plan the cycles of life for the ancients. They're planting, they're reaping, the celebrations, the festivals that they had. So that was underneath. The knowing the cycles of life, the coming, the going, the rising, the falling, the ebb and the flow. And a crown of 12 stars. 12 was another symbolic number for the Hebrews, representing the full expression. And so this is a part of us, this woman in the story, this vision that's there, is our creative abilities, who we are. Now, many times we have talked ourselves out or allowed others to talk us out of who we really are. And for us to get in touch again with the radiance of who we are, regardless of what other people's stories are, regardless of what our human history is, to recognize that we are co-heirs with Christ. And that radiance of that Christ Spirit is pictured as a woman who is able to bring forth something wonderful. So we'll go on here. Then another sign appeared in the heavens, an enormous red dragon. Great. In the book of Revelation, we get this stuff again. Huh? With 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. So the symbolic numbers here again. Historically, what the dragon is Rome, the Roman Empire. Remember the 7 hills of Rome? So the 7. And the 10 represents the 10 emperors. And we'll get this. And then again, this is, we've had a beast before. We're going to have a couple other beasts coming up. This is a dragon that we have here. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. Well, just to, again, to remember that we can't take this literally, with the stars, in chapter 6, with the 6th seal, all the stars fell from the sky. In chapter 8, with the 4th trumpet, 1/3 of the stars were struck and turned black. So again, it's not literal, but symbolic about a change. And what that represents, the stars represent our ideas, our goals, the things that we want to do that seem to get knocked down by this dragon. What it means in a mystical sense is that part of us that has been convinced that we are other than children of God. That part of us that has believed in separation, that has believed in defeat, that has believed in endings. That's what the dragon, the red dragon, represents. And we'll see what happens. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. What happens when you tell somebody about your goal, something that you want to do? Many times it gets devoured, doesn't it? As soon as you let it out of your mouth. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. So again, this many times interpreted as Jesus. But Jesus is already in heaven, isn't he? Jesus is already at the throne. So again, what this is about is that birth of an idea, when it happens, it's already established in heaven. It's already fulfilled in the kingdom of God. So it's already there. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. So again, the numbers are important. 1,260, another place we heard about 42 months. In the lunar calendar, there's 360 days in a year. So 1260, and we'll see this again, they talk about time, 2 times, and half a time. 3.5 years is, in the lunar calendar, 1,260 days, or 42 months. So what is it? Half a 7. So it's a time of moving out, of being seemingly separated. But the wilderness has a very interesting meaning for the people of Israel. If you remember that when Elijah was called to speak to King Ahab and said there was going to be a drought, then the Spirit said to him, go out into the desert by the brook, and the ravens will come and take care of you. And it says the ravens came morning and night and gave him bread and meat. Well, some people say that the ravens was a code name for Arabs, because they didn't want to think of them in a nice way, so they used the term ravens for them. But he was taken care of. So the wilderness was a place of protection, a place of being apart. And in that place, he was taken care of. We think of Jesus going into the wilderness. We think of his temptation, the temptation of the devil, of Satan. But again, what was that about? It's about clearing what his purpose was, what his ministry was, and realizing that the personal temptations that come to all of us can be overcome. And once he did that, it says the angels came and ministered unto him. So the wilderness was about a place of where you would go apart, but there was protection, there was taking care of that took place in there. And this is where this is for her. So our creativity, which this woman represents, sometimes seems like it's not there for a time, 2 times, and half a time. But it's a time where it seems to retreat, but that idea is already established. It's already in heaven. And so that woman will come back. and will have its expression again. And then there was a war in heaven. And this is the beginning of what's called Armageddon. It starts in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. Now the name Michael means one like God. And so it's that image of within us, that identification within ourselves. Do we have any Michaels here? No Michaels today. No. But he was not strong enough, the dragon was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down. The ancient serpent, called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray, he was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. If you remember what Jesus said about the devil, he said he is a liar and the father of lies. In the Aramaic idiom, what that means is that the devil is the biggest lie there ever was. That what opposes us is not some force outside of us. What opposes us is our own misbelief about who we are. When we believe who we are, when we know who we are as sons and daughters of God, co-heirs with Christ, when we know that and believe that and live from that, yes, things will show up, but only for us to bless, only for us to move through, only for us to overcome. And the devil is the belief that we can't do it. And see, from a human point of view, we can't. But we have a Michael. We have that part of us, like God, the Christ that is within us, that is like God, that can make that overcoming work in our own lives. Okay, and then there's a song, a wonderful song. Now have come the salvation and power in the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ, for the accuser of our brothers who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. It goes on. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, which means that life-giving power of the Christ that is within us, by the word of their testimony. That's when we keep telling the truth, when we keep affirming who we are as children of God, when we keep affirming life and love and joy, that's our testimony that helps us break through. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you and filled with fury, because he knows his time is short. So in other words, these difficulties that we face, again, a time, two times, and half a time, it's not literally about 3.5 years, but it's just a time that faces, it seems longer than we'd like it to be, but it is not something that will last. When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle. So again, the ability to rise above the circumstances of life so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert where she would be taken care of for a time, two times, and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of her life. When we feel like we're being overrun, when we're being flooded out with experiences, there's that help that is there. Then the dragon was enraged and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony. So from a historical view, John was writing to the persecuted Christians in the time of Rome, saying this beast is going to rise up with 10 horns, no, 7 heads, 10 horns. He says, but we'll be taken care of. We'll be taken care of. There's something greater that is at work. For ourselves, we can think of another way of looking at these 7 heads of the beast is what traditionally are called the 7 deadly sins or the 7 cardinal sins. The stuff that gets in the way of our belief in who we are as children of God. And I could enumerate them, but we've all had practice, haven't we? We know which ones that we get caught in, so I don't need to tell you that. And the 10 horns represent our 5 senses plus the way that we interpret those. So it's 5 plus 5 to equal the 10. And we can think of those, the five senses, in this way. The hearing, our hearing becomes selective sometimes, doesn't it? We only hear what we want to hear, and we filter out other conversation. I've got a couple that's getting married in a couple years, a couple months in New Orleans, and they're required to have premarital counseling. So we're coming in. They said, "Oh, the relationship is great." So I gave them a communications model to work with, and they came back and says, "Boy, you sure created a lot of problems." And I said, you don't talk together so well after all, do you? And it was very interesting for them to recognize how they danced around certain issues because they were issues and didn't really talk about them. And now as they're talking about them, it's difficult, but clarity is coming and they're encouraged and they want to keep up the work, which I thought was good. So to recognize that we don't always want to hear. With our sight, sometimes we see only negativity. We only see what's wrong. We only see what isn't working. We only see the people who are problems, those people out there. With our ability to smell, sometimes we get suspicious. Something smells fishy to me. And we use that sight again to look at what's wrong. Our taste becomes selective and we find certain things in life distasteful, rather than looking for the good and being that blessing. And with our sense of touch, sometimes we get touchy. Oh, don't say anything to her right now. Just leave him alone. He'll be okay later. Yeah. And again, it's easy to identify when somebody else is that way. But to recognize that we can turn these around. What is it that we want to hear? You know, in one way, we think about it, that what we think of sound, there's no sound out here. The sound happens when vibrations in the air reach our ear and are changed into nerve impulses. Then it becomes sound. It's just vibration out here. We interpret it in a certain way. How do we interpret that? How do we interpret the movement of life? We recognize that there are many things that set things in motion. There are many things that set vibrations, visible and invisible. It's easy to believe in the visible things because we see them. But it is the invisible things of spirit that are real and true. And for us to listen to spirit, to listen between what people are saying, to listen from that Christ within and see what it is telling us about what's going on, what people are doing, what people are saying. Same thing with our sight. What is it that we see? Do we see just what's there? Our sight is very limited. Particularly me, I've got these new contact lenses. And they're not working the way I'd like them to. And I have to struggle to read and all kinds of things. I'm going to the optometrist next week. But it's, you know, it's a challenge. And but what it reminds me is that I don't see very clearly. Not just in a physical sense, but in a metaphysical sense. I don't always see what's going on in my own life and certainly in others' lives. But to recognize that when we learn to see that we are children of God, to behold the Christ in ourselves and others, then we see something differently. We have our sense of smell. Several weeks ago, we talked about the fragrance of spirit, being the fragrance of the Christ. You know, we sort of look at others and, you know, turn our nose up a little bit, but can we smell the fragrance of the Christ in others? And to recognize that when we sniff out the truth, when we sniff out the power of God and put it to work, then these goals and dreams and energies that God has given us will come true. Taste. One of my ways of trying to describe my experience of God in the silence is to say that it's delicious. Doesn't make any sense, does it? How can God be delicious? How can experience of God be delicious? Yet, it is. And those who've experienced that, have, you know, it's like, that's a way you try to grasping at words, at images, to try to make it real. But to look for a sense of the deliciousness of life, because there is so much that we have in an outer physical way that is wonderful, that is amazing. You know, we had, as we were here yesterday, we did a blessing for the animals, and they were working on the inventory in the bookstore, and they were getting ready for the library book sale. And the sun was out, and some of us were standing in the patio, and it was just a gorgeous, gorgeous morning. And I said, this is delicious experience for us to look for those and be grateful. And then to touch. How is it that we touch life? How is it that we use our mind to touch the circumstances of our life? How is it that when we're thinking about the things we're trying to manipulate in life, that we use our sense of touch to say, well, this is bad and I need to fix it? Or to say that this is in process of growing into the maturity, growing into a ripeness in spirit. If you grow fruit or grow vegetables, you recognize that that when they first appear on the vine or on the tree, you don't eat them then. A ripeness has to come upon them, and they grow into that ripeness. And so if we can touch things lightly, touch things with love, and this is, we can do this in a way just with our own body. If you have a part of your body that isn't the way you like it to be, just to touch it. To touch it with love. As the people that you're dealing with, and again, whether you physically touch them or not, but you can come up and just touch them on the shoulder. And whatever you're saying to them or however you're listening to them, just know that you're touching them with God's love. The circumstances of life. As you're working with someone else that you want to see their life changed in some way, rather than touching them with a mind of concern, touch them with a mind of blessing, with a mind of divine order, with a mind of healing. And see that you give that touch. You know, we have that phrase that says, you know, God has no hands except the ones that he's given you to use and be a blessing. I like the Old Testament verse that says, underneath are the everlasting arms. We are held in those arms, and we can become the extension of that touch, that healing touch, that loving touch to those around us. There are two psalms that echo these ideas. The first is the 91st psalm. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High, under the shadow of the Almighty. And it's an invitation to come into a sense of being in God's presence. And if you're familiar with the psalm or not familiar with the psalm, I invite you to go and read it again, to read what it's about. Another psalm that touches me very much is the 22nd psalm. It begins with the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus recited this psalm from the cross. Why? Because it moves from a consciousness of limited human pain and turmoil into a consciousness of connectedness with God and God's glory. It's a wonderful psalm. And it says that there are, and it uses powerful Eastern images, there are bulls that surround me to tear me apart. There are lions ravenous to eat me. My bones have been broken. My flesh pours out. Very dramatic images. But it says, I will praise your name in the sanctuary, among the congregation, among the brothers and sisters. I will praise your name and tell of your great works. And then if we think of the order of the Psalms, after the 22nd comes the 23rd. The Lord is my shepherd. And for the Eastern mind, the shepherd was the one who didn't just take care of the sheep. It was mainly about feeding, taking them out to a place that was safe from water that moved too fast, safe from the beasts, safe from those who would steal. A safe place in which to be. God's protection there always. So I invite you to read the 91st Psalm, the 22nd, and the 23rd Psalm. There's a story that I read recently about a woman who had epilepsy. And one of the things she found is that when she went running, she didn't have seizures. And so she asked her dad if she could go running with her every day. And so when she was in high school, she asked her dad, what's the longest that a woman has ever run? And he looked it up, and it was 80 miles. And so as a freshman in high school, she says, I'm going to run from Orange County to San Francisco, which is 400 miles. As a sophomore, she decided, I'm going to run to Portland, Oregon, which was 1,500 miles. And then she says, as a junior, I'll run to St. Louis, 2,000 miles. And as a senior, I'll run to the White House. And that was her goal. And one of the interesting things, when a man was telling about her story one time, her father was in the audience. And he stood up and he says, you know, not only did she run those miles, but she raised enough money in those to set up 19 different multi-million dollar epileptic research centers in the United States. Now, we could look at someone who has epilepsy and say, oh, isn't that too bad? Better be careful. better sit down. Oh, sit down. Please be careful. You know. But she had something that she was giving birth to that was much bigger than, oh, you better be careful. Something much more that she knew could be brought forth. And I'm sure there were those around her that would be represented by the red dragon, and thoughts within her that would be represented by that too. But there was also within her a conviction that something more could happen. And whether she interpreted that as a spiritual experience or not really doesn't matter to us, because we can recognize that it was the Spirit of God within her saying, yet more. Whatever seems to be, God has for us yet more. So let's just say, God has for me yet more. Together, God has for me yet more. So when we say yet more, let's say that, yet more, we know that the Spirit is calling us out to a birthing process of something greater. And regardless of what the difficulties, regardless of what seems to oppose us, how big the dragon seems that's in front of us, there is protection, there is that Spirit that moves us through to something greater. Our creativity is a divine part of ourselves, God-given, for us to move out of our human consciousness into an expression of that gift that is ours, the Christ. Let us pray. Dear God, we are wonderfully grateful for your Spirit that works in and through us. We know that whatever we are facing, that your Spirit makes us more and yet more. Thank you, God. Amen. Now, Tonya, please come and lead us in our meditation hymn.